This is Philosophy Bites with me, Nigel Warburton.
And me, David Edmonds.
Philosophy Bites is unfunded. Please help us keep it going by subscribing or donating at www.philosophybites.com, or you can become a patron at Patreon.
If I got attacked by a crocodile while swimming, my death would be A, painful, and B, unlucky. The process of dying can be full of suffering. But what about death itself? Is there anything to fear about non-existence? Is death, as opposed to dying, something to regret? Shelley Kagan has been reflecting on the philosophy of death.
Shelley Kagan, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thank you very much for having me.
The topic we're going to focus on is death and deprivation. Before we get on to deprivation, let's just talk a bit about dying. It seems to me that dying, for all of us, the process of dying, is likely to be quite a bad thing.
Well, for many of us, the process of dying is a painful one. You can have a painful disease. I could be eaten alive by Bengali tigers. That would be a really painful way to die. But you can also die painlessly in your sleep. And it doesn't seem to me that the central way in which death is bad is the process. There's something about death itself that's bad and undesirable.
Many people do fear dying, but some people fear death itself. They fear that they will no longer exist. But how can that be bad when I won't be there when I no longer exist, by definition?
Right. This is sometimes known as the problem of the subject. It's a completely different question if you believe in an afterlife and are worried, will you end up in heaven or will you end up in hell? Typically, the contemporary philosophical discussions of this problem work with the assumption that death really is the end. That's certainly what I believe. And so if I won't exist after my death, now you've got something puzzling. How can non-existence be bad for me? I won't be there to experience non-existence. It's not as though I'll be in the coffin wishing I were alive, being bored, aching in my muscles or anything like that. There are no bad experiences, and so one might wonder, how can death be bad at all?
So one answer is that it deprives me of something, namely the chance of experiencing more of the world. So I'm 54. If I don't make it to 55, you know, that's a reasonable length of time that I could have expected to live that I won't then live, and I could have had really amazing experiences. So I will have been deprived by my early death.
Right. That's known as the deprivation account, and it does seem to me to put its finger on the central way in which death is bad. What's bad about death, when it's bad, is precisely that had you continued living, then the next chunk of life that you would have had would have been good for you overall. It needn't be that it's good solely, that is, it can be bad elements mixed in with the good ones, but as long as, on balance, the good outweighs the bad, then to not get it, to be deprived of it, is a loss.
So that's it then. We've solved that problem. Let's move on to another.
Well, in some sense, I think we have solved the problem. Unfortunately, the solution then brings new problems in its wake. So suppose that you agree with the central idea that death is bad because there was a good thing that you could have gotten that you didn't get. And as a result, it makes sense in contemplating the non-occurrence of this good, it makes sense for me to feel regret, to be upset, to be concerned. It's a misfortune. The trouble is, there are a lot of other goods that don't come my way constantly, every day. So to give an easy example, Bill Gates did not write a check for me today for $1 million. And I imagine that Bill Gates didn't write a check for $1 million to anybody listening to this podcast. But nobody is upset at the thought that Bill Gates didn't write them a check for $1 million, at least nobody who wasn't had any good reason to anticipate it. Or to give a somewhat more fanciful example that the philosopher Kai Draper introduced, I didn't find Aladdin's lamp today. Wouldn't that have been wonderful? Had I found Aladdin's lamp, that would have been a great thing. So I was deprived of that good. Does it mean that I should be really upset that I didn't get it? Well, that seems wrong. And yet, if we're going to use the deprivation account to say, here's why death is bad, it seems as though it commits us out of consistency to saying, it's also a misfortune that I didn't get the $1 million. And that seems wrong.
Well, if I die tomorrow, I won't see my children grow up more than they have done already. That seems to me a deprivation. But I could live for many hundreds of years without getting a check from Bill Gates. So that doesn't seem a deprivation. That seems something different. That's just something I might have wished for that I couldn't reasonably expect.
Right. So I think if we ask ourselves, how do we tweak the deprivation account? Or is there some way that we can modify it so as to allow us to appeal to it, on the one hand, to say that death is bad because I'm not getting the goods that would have come my way, and yet at the same time allow us to avoid having to say, so not getting the $1 million from Gates, I don't really have to be upset about that. We need some way to distinguish the cases. And a plausible thought is to say, we need to pay attention to how likely was it that this good thing that didn't come your way would have come your way. Was it a near miss, or was it virtually inevitable that it wouldn't have come your way? If you get hit crossing the street by a car because you were too busy discussing philosophy and didn't pay attention, but you could easily have looked up and gotten out of the way of the car in time, then it's a near miss that you didn't avoid the accident. The good of continued life almost came your way. In contrast, the fact that I didn't get a $1 million check from Bill Gates or didn't get Aladdin's lamp, it was inevitable, virtually inevitable, that those good things were not going to come my way. And so a tremendous amount of discounting needs to occur. And so somebody who got upset at not getting the $1 million from Bill Gates, that wouldn't make any sense. On the other hand, suppose that, like in King Lear, your father is going to decide who to give the kingdom to, and he picks your sibling instead of you. Regret there, a great deal of regret, makes sense because it was a very close thing. And so part of the way of preserving the deprivation account, which then allows us to explain why death is bad, while nonetheless avoiding the apparent counterexamples, the Aladdin's lamp, the Bill Gates check, and so forth, is to suggest that the amount of regret that makes sense needs to be discounted for the remoteness of the possibility. And this works actually in two directions. It's not just that if there's a good thing that I didn't get, then it makes sense to have a lot of regret if it was a close call, if I almost got it. Yet if it was a very remote possibility, then I shouldn't be very upset. Not only are these thoughts true for goods, there are corresponding thoughts for bads as well. So, for example, I think this example is Tom Herka's. I didn't get abducted by space aliens this morning who did not take me off to their intergalactic torture chamber. Now, why isn't this a source of tremendous relief to me that this bad thing didn't occur? Normally, when bad things don't occur, you're relieved. Why isn't that one something that we should be relieved by? Because the possibility of being abducted by space aliens is so utterly remote that by the time you're doing the discounting, there's little or no rational grounds for being pleased.
What about if I'm sitting here and I've got a lottery ticket that's the winning ticket for the lottery, it's got $1 million, I die, the lottery had already been run, I have the winning ticket in my pocket, I die without knowing I didn't check my ticket. Does that present any problems for your account?
Right. So one distinction that we need to draw is between, as we might say, the objective facts about what would have come your way and how likely it was to have come your way versus how remote a possibility it was. And in terms of the size of the good, the objective facts about whether it would be very large or small, and subjective takes on whether or not this was a remote possibility or a close possibility. Was there a good there at all in the offing? What size it might be? So these distinctions between subjective takes and objective takes show up throughout philosophy, but in particular they show up in ethics a lot. If my subjective take on what was going to happen tomorrow if I hadn't died today is way off, then we might want to say something like, from the objective perspective, there wasn't much of a misfortune there, but perhaps from the subjective perspective, it seemed like a misfortune, or it was subjectively regret made sense. We might want to distinguish between subjectively rational regret and objectively rational regret. There are different locutions that we could introduce that would be analogs of the locutions that get introduced in other parts of ethics.
I'm trying to think how this applies to the case of deprivation of life that occurs at death. So subjectively, as I approach the end, it feels it could always go on a bit longer and that would be good. So I'm subjectively deprived. But objectively, it couldn't go on forever. So how do you play off those subjective and objective expectations in terms of regret?
Let's step back for a moment and let me frame it slightly differently. So I was advocating the view that how much regret makes sense to have when a good doesn't come your way needs to be discounted for the remoteness of the possibility of getting the good. We introduced this idea, so as to have an answer to the Bill Gates and Aladdin lamp problem. Why doesn't it make sense to be upset about those? Oh, the answer is because that's very remote. We introduced the Bill Gates problem because that seemed to be an implication of the deprivation account. This is philosophy for you. One thing leads to the other, leads to the other. So we introduced the deprivation account so as to have an explanation as to why death is bad. But now there's a problem. The problem is that we may have undermined the initial story we wanted to tell about death being bad. Because, after all, it is inevitable that you're going to die. And if it doesn't make sense to be regretting things that are inevitable, then it seems as though I've now painted myself into a corner where I have to say, so it doesn't really make sense to be upset about death after all. But the answer, I think, was suggested by your question from a moment ago, which is to say that I will die sooner or later, that's inevitable. And so I think perhaps, objectively speaking, there's nothing rational to regret about that, barring some modifications of the theory where maybe there's room for a little bit of residual regret, even for the inevitable. But if I die, if you die, did you say you were 54? If you die at 54, then you can regret that you didn't make it to 55. Lots of people make it to 55. I made it to 55. There's room for regret that you didn't get that extra year. And if you were to have made it to 55, there'd be room for regret that you didn't make it to 56, because lots of people make it to 56. And 57, 58, people make it to their 60s, 70s, 80s. Now, as each year progressively goes on, it's less and less likely, even if you've made it to that year, that you're going to make it for another year. And so the amount of rational regret gets incrementally smaller and smaller and smaller until you reach the point at which, objectively speaking, right now, given current circumstances, no humans live more than, 115, 120 years? I forget what the verified record is, but something in that neighborhood. That may actually change, right? One reads in the papers all the time that they're on the verge of developing biotechniques that will allow people to live to 120, 130, 140, 150. Once that comes through, then, of course, there'll be more grounds for regretting that you didn't live longer. So there is still grounds for regretting that you die when you die, assuming that you die before the maximum lifespan. But then you also made another very nice point, which is that subjectively, we just largely disregard the facts about nobody makes it more than 115. I mean, almost nobody makes it past 100. And so we always think there's a possibility. And then that brings us back to the subjective amount of regret. Given your belief that you could have lasted at least a little bit longer, even if that really wasn't in the cards, objectively speaking, but given that you believe it, there'll be a kind of notion of subjective regret that will still make some sense.
This is really interesting because it seems to suggest a way of living, thinking about your own death, that the younger you are, the more you can regret an imminent death. The older you get, the less plausible it is that you are going to live a lot longer. So it's rational to feel less concern about your impending death.
I think that's right. And of course, it's a common enough thought that when somebody dies at 20, then this is a horrible loss, a misfortune, something that it makes sense for them to regret. When somebody dies at 80 or 90 or 100, the later they get especially, the less grounds they have to feel that they've undergone a misfortune. And this kind of account helps us make sense of that.
We've been focusing on the idea of death as a deprivation, but many people have a fear of death, of non-existence, and it's not because they could have gone on a bit longer necessarily. It's just the idea that they're not going to be here. It's not about continued existence at all.
We have to be clear about what we're talking about here. It's the fear of death, not the fear of dying painfully. The fear of death does seem to me to be widespread. Although it's not directly connected with what we've been talking about up to this point, nonetheless, I do think that that's actually a mistake. Emotions have appropriateness conditions. If I were to take pride in the Russian basketball team winning the Olympics, you might look to me and ask, are you Russian? And I say, no. Did you finance the Russian team? I'd say, no. Do you particularly follow the Russian team? And I say, no. You would then wonder, how can pride there make sense? The thing you are proud of has to have the relevant kind of connection to you. All right. So different emotions have different appropriateness conditions. Fear, another emotion, has an appropriateness condition. Now, one of the obvious appropriateness conditions is the things got to be that you're afraid of has to be bad. And the deprivation account helps us see the way in which it's bad. So there's something there to be afraid of. But that's not the only appropriateness condition. I believe, more controversially, that fear is only an appropriate emotion if there's some uncertainty about the coming or the size of or the nature of the bad thing. So that if you're going to hit me, I can be afraid because I don't know how much pain I'm going to undergo. So fear there makes sense. But suppose we had a little machine that would deliver an electric shock and my hand is on the machine. There are no dials on the machine, so it can only deliver exactly the same size shock of exactly the same duration. So you do it to me once, twice, three times, four times, five times, and it's unpleasant, but I see exactly how unpleasant it is. And now you say, I'm going to do it for you again. I want to say that at that point, fear of the upcoming pain doesn't make sense. There's nothing there to be afraid of. I can be upset that you're going to shock me again. I can be sad or resentful. But precisely because I know the bad thing is coming in exactly what its size is, it seems to me that fear at that point doesn't make sense. An analogy I sometimes share with my students is you're in high school and you're at a party and your mother is going to call you at midnight. And at midnight, you're going to have to go home and go to sleep. You'd rather stay at the party longer. But you know the call is going to come at midnight. Now, in a situation like that, you're going to suffer the deprivation, the loss of the party. You'd rather have more. And so a deprivation account, it makes sense here. But if you were to say to your friends, I'm afraid that my mother is going to call at midnight, that doesn't make sense. You know that your mother is going to call at midnight. And so I think the relevant appropriateness conditions for fear of death, given that death is actually inevitable, that really doesn't make sense. There's still residual room for fear of death coming sooner rather than later. And they're analogous to the points I was making at the outset about discounting for likelihoods, unlikelihoods. That all needs to be done as well. So if you're a reasonably healthy 20-year-old, 30-year-old, 40-year-old, 54-year-old, then the having made it this far, the chances of you dying anytime soon are extremely unlikely. And so there, too, the amount of fear it would make sense for you to have is very slim. So I think that some concern about dying sooner rather than later makes sense, but the kind of sheer existential terror at the very thought of non-existence, I think that's a confusion. I should say, however, that nobody in my family thinks I'm right about this. Everybody, my wife, my kids, they all think I'm completely crazy.
Just to get this clear, on your account, death is a deprivation, and that's why it's bad for us. What it deprives us of varies according to where we are in the natural cycle of life, as it were, but it does deprive us of something. Now, is that the only reason why death is bad?
There are other aspects of death which I think arguably augment its badness. I think the fact that death is ubiquitous, it's not just that I'm going to die, it's that death could happen any time at all. I could suffer a brain aneurysm as we're conducting this interview, and I could just die. And I think, speaking personally, this is an extra burden. If there were death-free times, that would be a relief. If nobody could die between noon and 1:30, then at least during that hour and a half, it would be gone. You wouldn't have to think about it. On the other hand, I suppose that would be counterbalanced by the increased anxiety of taking on the yoke of mortality at 1:29. So the ubiquity of death, I think, is an interesting fact about it. Another aspect about it, and it's related to ubiquity, the sheer unpredictability of when you're going to die. Interestingly, I think people differ about this. Imagine that there were some genetic test that you could undergo that would reveal, a blood test, that would reveal, here's exactly how long you're going to live. You're going to make it to 59, Nigel, 59, 2 months and 3 days. And you could have learned that at the age of 20. Some people find that prospect very, very upsetting and wouldn't want it. Other people, and me, myself, in certain moods, would think that would be worth knowing.
What about the idea that the existence of death isn't something bad for human beings? It's actually what focuses us on what matters in life and somehow stimulates us to make the most of what we find around us rather than postponing it or having fears about taking action.
People sometimes suggest that if we lived forever and knew we were going to live forever, then we'd never do anything. You know, why start? You could always start tomorrow or next year or 1,000 years from now. On the other hand, there are things that might take forever. There are certain mathematical problems that perhaps if you had an infinite period of time, you could just solve by going through each number and checking it out. And even if we lived forever, there would probably be the possibility of making mistakes. There could be things that you would go after that you would decide were not really worthy goals. And so I think, although some of the pressure that we're under to choose wisely, to be careful, is exaggerated, is amplified by virtue of the fact that we don't have forever, strictly speaking, even immortality would allow the possibility of blowing it. I think that facing the facts about death help make us appreciate the fact that life is a very scarce resource and you need to spend it wisely. On the other hand, I'm less sympathetic. I don't have a single mind about the claim that sometimes gets made that things only have value because we're mortal. I think there are plenty of goods that their value is not keyed into whether or not we live forever. When I open up a candy bar and I eat it, it takes 3 minutes. If I've really got self-control, sometimes it lasts 5 minutes. And the value of eating the candy bar, perfectly real. And if you tell me I'm going to live for 30 years, I'm going to live for 100 years, I'm going to live for 10,000 years, I'm going to live forever, I don't think living forever would make it any less worth eating the candy bar. So I'm not one of those people who think, thank God we are mortal, because otherwise nothing would be worth doing, nothing would have any value. That seems to me an overstatement.
Do you think it's just a difference in temperament that I have from you then? Because I think that the fact that I will die inevitably gives value to things I do, that it would be rather tedious, to use Bernard Williams's adjective, to keep living forever, because you'd exhaust novelty pretty quickly and there's too much time. It's like being stuck in a cocktail party that never ends.
Good. So the question we were asking about a minute ago was, would anything be worth doing if you were immortal? And I think the answer to that is yes. But there's a different question, which is, would it be desirable to live forever? And that's the question I think you've just posed. And you suggested, following Bernard Williams, that eventually it would all grow tedious. I do actually believe that as well. So I do think that eventually life would grow excruciatingly dreadful, boring, tedious, no matter what it was filled with. But for all that, it would still have been true that during the initial satisfying, richly rewarding 100 years, 500 years, however long it would take before it got boring, those initial 500 years would still have been worth living. They were still good. To give a humdrum everyday analogy, if you offer me a piece of chocolate, I love chocolate. Thank you, thank you, thank you. You offer me a second piece of chocolate. I love chocolate. Third piece of chocolate. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Now, there must be some number. I don't have any idea what the number is in my entire life. I've never gotten close to this number, but I believe there must be some number, pieces of chocolate, at which I would say, no more. Chocolate is no longer a good thing for me at this point. I'm not enjoying it. But even if that point would inevitably come, for all that, it would still have been true that the first 5 pieces or a dozen pieces or 20 pieces were still delicious and still wonderful. So that's the way I think about life. The value of life doesn't require mortality. But for all that, an immortal life would not be a desirable one.
Shelley Kagan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
For more Philosophy Bites, go to www.philosophybites.com. You can also find details there of Philosophy Bites books and how to support us. We now have 2 more podcasts. Nigel has one on philosophers and places they're associated with, www.philosophysites.com, and I have a podcast devoted specifically to moral and political philosophy, www.philosophy247.org.